10 years, you want that person to be going to a job interview and someone says to them, Bayo, what do you think qualifies you for this role as CRO, executive director? And you can sit back confidently and go, I'm so glad you asked that question because I've been preparing for this moment for 10 years. Because what companies need less of is people who just turn up and do stuff. They want people who are going to contribute and lead and grow and become thought leaders in their business. So differentiate yourself that way. I literally love what I do. I'd probably do it for free. If I work for you as a consultant, I don't mean that.
Yes. Today's episode is all about leadership. Join me as I speak to commercial leader Jamie Clahesi as we talk about what it takes to make it as a sales manager, the difference between management and leadership, and what it takes to land your dream job in the e-commerce industry. And guys, if you like the content, you know what to do. Make sure to like, subscribe, share. You know it does wonders for us. Now enjoy the show. Hi guys, welcome to another episode of What My Best Friend Does, where we talk to your best friends in the hope of inspiring you to take immediate action. Today, I'm joined by my best friend, the commercial leader, Jamie. How you doing?
I'm good. Great to be here and thanks for the opportunity. I'm a huge fan of this series. I'm just overwhelmed at the opportunity, so thank you.
I'm thoroughly grateful to have you on the podcast. We do like to start with a little icebreaker.
Okay.
What did you want to be growing up?
I think the usual stuff, right? I wanted to be a soldier. Yeah, I wanted to be a sports person. I wanted to, whenever I saw people riding a motorbike, I used to shout, motorbike man, motorbike man. I've done two of those to a reasonable level.
Yeah.
I'm a terrible sports person. Okay. I'm a great winner, but a terrible loser. But I'm obsessed with motorbikes. So yeah, those are the three things I wanted to do.
Okay, so you said sportsman, motorbike man, and you said you wanted to be a soldier.
Yeah.
You've done two of the three. Let's go way, way back.
Yeah.
Can you talk us through your early upbringing and your career experience up until this point?
Yeah, early upbringing. That's a great one. So I'm the youngest of six, for what it's worth. Maybe a function of that is maybe shouting to be heard, and that maybe pushed me into commercial roles. Our family is a bit of a hodgepodge, which I love about it, in that we did a lot of M&A, like mergers and acquisitions in the 90s. So We're all from different backgrounds, which is, again, it adds to the rich tapestry of our family. My family still live in that same home I grew up in North London, Kensal Rise. And then my career kind of started in a fairly non-traditional way. I spent the first 6 years or so doing a mixture of military service, full-time reserve service, full-time and reserve service.
Sorry to jump in there. Was that straight out of school? Did you go to university?
Yeah, I went to university.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And then you took the decision to go and serve?
Exactly.
Okay, great. And how was that experience?
I look back at it and I'd recommend it to anybody. It was a great experience for me in lots of ways. Foundationally, it taught me lots of lessons in life. Some of it was confirmatory. I don't think I can underestimate the impact of having good supportive parents all the way through my life. And also, I'm fortunate I came out of it. I had a great adventure. I came out of it unscathed. I don't know everybody who can tell the same story. So I feel very fortunate in that way.
Okay. And you did it for 6 years, was it?
6 years, yeah.
I suppose doing it for that amount of time, like, do you have your eye on the next thing? Was there like a point where you were like, okay, I've completed this. Now it's onto my next career.
No, the transition for me was I'd fought in a war in 2003, and I don't mean to belittle that because I know there's this huge impact for everyone involved in that. But I'd had that experience. I felt like it was kind of mission complete, and I wanted to get a proper job.
Yeah,
I wanted to move on and go into the next step of life. As it was, I was very fortunate, and someone hired me based on my qualities, not really my skills, because I didn't really have a number of super transferable skills. I've always been keen to learn, keen to be coached. I'm quite directional. If you give me stuff to do, I'll kind of go and do it. And as I got older, I got more mature, and I'm quite happy to apply my own processes and ways of working to that. But having that directional mindset has certainly stood me in a good stead.
So you mentioned the fact there that somebody hired you. What was your first role following that?
I started in a very traditional way as an SDR. It probably took me longer than most to get the hang of it because it was such a culture shock to me. But luckily they invested, they took the time, and I learned some good lessons in leadership in terms of patience from that role. I went on to become a pretty good salesperson, a pretty good sales manager, a pretty good sales director, and then into cross-functional leadership.
Yeah.
And then that's managing multiple teams and becoming kind of the de facto guy for scaling up EMEA tech businesses. Oh, so that's been my journey so far. I hope it's not over. I'm also focusing at the moment on some kind of consultancy work, go-to-market, building sales playbooks and that kind of pieces of work, which I'm enjoying.
I love it. So as somebody who has been through so many facets of the sales world, I've got so many questions. I think I've had a few salespeople on this podcast. I've had a few sales managers.
Yeah.
No disrespect to them. You've obviously taken a couple of steps above that. One of the burning questions I had was, we've heard about individual contributor versus sales manager. What would you say the main difference is first between like a sales manager and a sales director?
That's a great question. I think a part of that is around scale, the scale of the business, and also around titling, right? Because actually, you go to some businesses, a sales manager can be an individual contributor, or you can have an IC as a sales director, or a sales director could be a traditional person who manages multiple managers and manages, a second line leadership role. So it's kind of nuanced. I would just draw the distinction between management and leadership as the succinct difference, really. I think leadership is about vision. It's about creating a safe space for people to be able to be themselves. And management is more around the day-to-day management of your rotas and holidays and making sure people are on time and you've got the right kit and the right tech. But I'd rather than focusing on titles, I'd be far more inclined to think about the difference between leadership and management, which is where I see the intersection of my career really accelerating. About 8-9 years ago, I'd had some jobs, I'd been successful, but we had a baby on the way. It's my first one, and that was the catalyst for me to say, I don't want to be good at this anymore. I want to be absolutely brilliant at this. And I'm not arrogant enough to say I want to be the best in the world at it, but my mindset is always to be, I want to be the top 5% in the world.
I love that.
I want to be the person that people go to when they think of this particular role. And that's coloured the way I think about how I coach people and mentor people as well. To add a bit more commentary there.
I do. And I actually want to dive even deeper into that. So you made a great point about, management and leadership, and leadership is having that vision.
Yeah.
For people who are listening to this and they're like, I want to be a leader and not a manager, is vision something you're born with? Is it something that you go out and learn? And if it is something that you learn, because you've spoken about developing people, what are the immediate steps people can do to get that 2020 vision, to go to the opticians? Opticians of leadership.
If the question is, how do I be a visionary? Yeah. I don't know, because I'm not one.
Okay.
But I think if you want to talk about how you can create a vision for people, or how you can motivate people with your vision, you can learn that.
Yeah.
Of course you can. I think you can learn by example and example setting. So I've had the fortune to work with some really great leaders, some real fine examples about people who put the team first, who think about the strategic goals, who can paint a picture of what happens if we do everything right, and also mitigate for risks. So, to add some colour onto that, you can absolutely learn to be a good leader.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone should be a good manager. Those are the foundational points of just going through your career and just being a good egg.
And then with what you were saying about how, in your time as an SDR, they really took time and invested into you.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is your approach to developing people who may be taking a longer time? Because I know working in tech, sometimes if the results aren't there, it can kind of be you're on the chop block. What is your approach to that when people aren't necessarily achieving what is potentially possible or capable of them?
We're in a fairly pressured environment in tech at the moment. The expectation is people deliver. My style has never been to put people on the chopping block. So I don't think that creates the right kind of positive pressure. It's never been my style. I just also not brought up that way. It's not the right thing to do. I'd rather train people to be successful. There's obviously an end state which you might get to where someone, in fact, I was speaking to somebody, mentoring someone yesterday who was going through probably the third or the fourth cycle of being an SDR where it hadn't worked. And I owed him the honesty of saying, do you know what? I don't think this is for you. You failed four times. You've got to this point where you haven't moved on to the next level. Maybe it's not for you. And that's all right. That's all right. So my counsel to him was, if you want to do this one more time, great. I'll fully support you. You know, give you the references you need, etc. Of course I will. But have a think about what you really want. Think about what you want to be. And that 10-year conversation is what I was going to lead on to saying, which is, you know, in 10 years, you want that person to be going to a job interview. Mm-hmm. And someone says to them, Bayo, what do you think qualifies you for this role as CRO, executive director? And you can sit back confidently and go, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I've been preparing for this moment for 10 years.
Yeah.
And that's the shot. That's the shot you want to be able to give your people. So make sure it's the right thing for them by temperament, by skill set. That's really important. But also make sure that fast forward 10 years, you're going to be with your right tribe. Because if I think about my wedding, there was lots of people I'd worked with, all different parts of my life. They're my tribe and I felt at home there. But by your tribe, I mean, you think about the people you're going to work with now. Fast forward 10 years' time. Do you want them at your wedding? I know you're getting married soon. Do you want them at a major family event? Yeah. Do you want them to be part of your life in 10 years' time? I'm very lucky, and there's lots of people that I've met throughout my career to date that, you know, I feel I'm part of their tribe as much as they're part of mine.
And do you feel like, I suppose, like when you're going for an interview process, it's as much about being sold the business as you're selling yourself to the business. Do you think it's quite easy to get that impression, I suppose? Because let's say you're interviewing for multiple jobs, and you know, you've got this 10-year plan and there's a lot of people after you. How do you make sure you make the right decision, I suppose, and make sure you get the tribe right?
If you're asking about me, I'll give you one answer. I think if you're speaking more generally, how do you make sure it's the right role? You cannot underestimate the importance of doing the real basics. Like, what problem does this business solve? Mm-hmm. Does it align with my values? Am I going to be okay having that same conversation 20 times a week for the next 5, 8, 10, 12 years?
Yeah.
Do I see a roadmap which excites me? Are there people in that business which I can learn from? Are they hiring the right caliber of people that when I become a manager, that I'd like them to be the kind of people that I lead? Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of questions I think about. But I think just doing the basics really well in terms of your due diligence, have a look at the reviews online, right? And ask the hiring manager the tough questions.
Yeah.
Like, I read this review from X or Y. Can you tell me about it? And a hiring manager worth their weight will say, well, this is a one-off example, or et cetera, et cetera. But having those questions, you know, ready and to mind, is, I think, it's really important. If you can do any kind of back channel research, you possibly can. It's going to be super helpful, because people will give you the unvarnished truth when you're outside of the interview environment.
Yeah.
Speak to competitors, see what they genuinely say about them, because it could well be that, you know, the way the market sees them is very different from the way they actually see themselves.
100%. And yeah, talking about all of that stuff, they're preparing for interviews. You must have interviewed a lot of people. You've been in a lot of interviews.
Yep.
When you're interviewing somebody, like, what are the key things that you're looking for to help somebody stand out? So for anybody listening to this who's potentially going for their next role, what can they immediately do after this in the next interview they have coming up to give themselves the best chance of securing a job?
Do the basics really well. Yeah. Pre-prep, ask for the agenda, thank them for their time. Do the basics in terms of researching the business, but have in your mind almost rehearsed why you think you're going to be a good fit for this business. Mm-hmm. So when someone asks you, you've got the answer to hand, so you're not scrabbling around going, oh, what makes you think you're going to be a really good SDR or account executive at our business, Jamie? You're not going,
Yeah.
You're going, well, because of my experience over the last 5 years in these particular roles, which closely aligns with the same market you're going after, I feel that my contact book would set me in a good trajectory. So I think about the typical interview questions you're going to get and prepare accordingly.
Yeah.
Do the basics really well. I'm a big believer in turn up really smart, dress for the job you want. As much as it's, you know, 2024, you wear you what you want. Don't wear what you want.
Yeah.
Turn up looking really smart. If I learn anything from COVID, is that people, first impressions matter, because we spend a reduced amount of time together. So take a notebook into the meeting, make notes, and signal to someone that you've done some prep by opening up your notebook and make it say, with a big bold thing saying, questions for interview.
Yeah.
It's another visual clue to you that I've put the hard yards in, that I've put the effort in.
I love that. And like, on the flip side of that, like, what are the things that you look, okay, this person probably isn't right for the role. What are the key red flags that people can avoid in interviews?
We could do a whole podcast on shocking interviews. but in the main, they're very few and far between. I think for me, the red flags is a lack of preparation.
Yeah.
It's like being late. It's the real simple things. I know that I don't have a type in terms of the kind of people I like to hire. Like, I really like diverse groups, but have a think about, as a candidate, how you're going to fit into the group that's in that company. Yeah. Start speaking about how you're going to, you know, I've looked online and I see you're very active in terms of supporting this particular charity. Have an opinion about the things which are going in terms of the pastoral mm-hmm. contributions of the business. Have an opinion on the industry. Because what companies need less of is people who just turn up and do stuff.
Yeah.
They want people who are going to contribute and lead and grow and become thought leaders in their business. So differentiate yourself that way.
100%. And just hearing you talk there, and even in the few interviews I've done, it really is surprising how many people don't know what the business do.
Yeah.
Like, they give you a generic answer about the job role that maybe they've Googled. Like, you think that it might sound overwhelming what you're saying to put in the work, but it's really not that hard to take a day or two and just read up, make some notes and align it to yourself. I was actually on a call with somebody earlier giving them advice about how to prepare for an interview, and I said, go onto the company's website, make sure you take a look at the company values, and just have some prepared examples about why you think you'd be a good fit because you align with their core values. So, yeah. And they were like, thank you. So I think even though it might seem obvious to us, to the listener, it might not necessarily be that obvious that these are the things you need to do to succeed.
I think that's great advice. And I'd also say, you know, it could be potentially a bit of a stretch to make 1 or 2 days prep, but it's definitely worth it. Like, the time you invest in the interview preparation definitely shows, but the least amount of time you want to spend is the ratio of 2 to 1. If it's an hour long interview, make sure you've done 2 hours prep for it at least. But if it's your dream job, 1 or 2 days, why not? What have you got to lose?
Exactly.
What have you got to lose?
Exactly. So moving into, yeah, more of what you're doing now, and as you mentioned, like building out go-to-market teams, like, what does that involve, building out a go-to-market team? Can you talk us through, yeah, like a typical day, week, month, the processes, and yeah, like the things that you're thinking about as a commercial leader to help execute on such a thing?
Yeah, I can tell you certainly what my process is at the moment and how I think about it. I start with what I call my BHAGs, mm-hmm. my big, hairy, audacious goals.
Okay.
So you take a team on, it's a handful of people, you're hoping they're great people. In the main, people are good, mm-hmm. so that's great. You start with the BHAGs. So where do I want this business or this business unit that I'm responsible for to be in 24 months? Mm-hmm. It could well be, if you think about for a go-to-market, so a sales organization, that you want to have a top 5% sales talent. Mm-hmm. You want to have a top 5% dedicated marketer resource in your region. You want to have a revenue ops person. All people that give you additional insights. You want to have a partner manager, mm-hmm. top 5%. Mm-hmm. Then dial back and work out what, in terms of the unit economics or the unit metrics you would need, how much business you'd need to book to make that a viable step, and what are the steps along the way that's going to get you to those BHAGs. You can't under communicate what that vision looks like to your team and to your people. So telling them, hey, we want to fast forward 2 years, and I'll give you a BHAG I've had, which is, I want our people, our processes and tools to be the industry standard. Mm-hmm. I want people to aspire to want to work for our business. And the way I'd measure that would be, how many of my competitors try and steal my people?
Yeah.
So those are the BHAGs. Then dial back in terms of what are the waypoints I need to get to be there in terms of the good sound unit economics of building a business. You can't underestimate the importance of training and coaching. Building a feedback loop is a really foundational part of building good culture. Mm-hmm. So for me, the feedback loop is always what you did well, what you did badly, what I would have done differently with a referenceable example. It sounds a bit tough to hear, but actually, every time you and me do a client engagement, you give me that feedback and I give you that feedback, that's super helpful. And that just builds a ton of trust, 100%. Which means every call we do, we get a bit better.
Yeah.
And there can be something a bit of a differential, because I've done calls with people who are newer in their career and they just go, oh, Chloe, you're brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I go, no, that's not an acceptable answer, because there's absolutely everything. There's always something I can do better every single time, because there's something we could always do better. So that foundational piece about building feedback loops is really important. I also think about building measurable, repeatable, and optimizable processes. So I've seen businesses which are an absolute slave to writing Notion documents, which are about a process, and then they kind of weaponize it and go, why didn't you read my 10-page Notion document on our process for purchasing a stapler? That's not the way you do it. You have like real short one-page plans or one short-page processes which you train and coach people on.
Okay.
So measurable people, optimize processes, make them quick and digestible, training and having big, hairy, audacious goals. Also, as a leader, you've got to get your hands dirty. That's really important that nothing's too, that you're not too grand to do anything. So you probably experienced my time at Yotpo. You know, I was super happy to move the office physically, load the truck and move the people for the first four times, 100%. To build the desks, to plug in the phones, to be on sales calls, to help write documents, to help write emails. So I think if you're doing all those things right as a commercial leader, you're pretty much on the right track. Additionally, revenue, like hitting your numbers is really important. All the rest of it, you know, is super important. I won't underestimate it, but actually performance and getting to your number and performance is really important.
And on that, like, performing and getting to your number, we're talking obviously about expanding the team, and I know you've mentioned, you know, having a 24 month goal as to where you want to be.
Yeah.
In terms of actually budgeting that out and making sure that you don't hire too many people too quickly or too slowly to stop you from hitting your goals, is there any advice that, you know, new leaders who are listening to this can glean from you to make sure that they hire at the right rate and grow at the optimal rate?
And that could be almost dissertation stuff. Yeah, absolutely. It starts with demand, right? How big is your pipeline? How many leads do you have incoming from SDRs, from marketing, from inbound, avoiding any kind of channel conflict? What's the individual number of units coming in? At what value? At what conversion rate?
Yeah.
Once you understand that, you can start to build out the unit economics of how many SDRs to sellers to close business do you need, to how many marketers versus how many salespeople to partner managers. So once you've done that foundational stuff, you're in a good place.
Do you know what? It's so funny as you've said that. Now I understand why I'm always hearing salespeople talk about having a clean pipeline. Because without the pipeline being clean, I suppose you can't make the correct forecasts and make sure you have the right resources in place.
Exactly.
So to all the salespeople, clean your sales force up. No, this has been great. And I think we've kind of touched upon it there, but for those people who are, you know, they look at that linear trajectory. So you start in sales, you become a sales manager, then you go into leadership. You've mentioned kind of shadowing. What would your advice be to people who are looking to take that next step? And how long typically does it take, right? Because I feel some people feel like, I'm an individual contributor for a couple of years, I do that well. I'm a manager for a few years, I do that well. All of a sudden, I'm entitled to be a leader. Is there like a typical process, or is it just based on like the growth of the company, the opportunities that are available, etc.?
That's a great question. I would say I've made almost every mistake you can make in the professional world. One of the worst ones I've made, and I've done it twice, is I've overpromoted people.
Okay.
I've had someone who's been chomping at the bit. They're just like, I'm ready, Chloe. I want to be an AE, or I'm ready. I want to take on this leadership role. And I've proceeded too quickly, and then they failed. Even with all the will in the world, the goodwill in the world and the support, they failed. And for lots of people, they can't go backwards, or there isn't a place for them to go backwards. Mm. So what they then do is they'll go somewhere else and they'll fail once more. And then they'll go somewhere else and they'll normally crack it. Mm. But they've had 18 months of pain.
Yeah.
And that could have been avoided if I'd just been a bit more judicious. So that's a painful lesson for me, and I'm mindful of it constantly now.
In terms of, like, you've mentioned there being judicious, like reflecting back on situations, what is it, why is it you felt it was too early? I know they were chomping at the bit, but on reflection, what do you think you would have done differently?
I would have delayed. I didn't have one of the great things about being a leader for a few cycles as I have is experience. Because I didn't have in my toolbox the experience to say, I've done this before and it will not serve you in the long run. So that was the lesson. Ultimately, I've now been in positions where I've delayed people or encouraged them to wait, like don't go looking elsewhere. I see a place for you in this role, but it's not now. And they've ultimately waited, they've invested, well, they've believed in me, and I've believed in them, and they've gone on to be really successful. So to answer your question directly, I don't think you need to put a time span on it.
Okay.
Everyone's in a huge rush, right?
Yeah.
And all these crazy titles that people have now, there's VPs and everyone's a director and everyone's a blah, blah, blah. Don't get hung up on it. Like, your career is really precious. Yeah, enjoy it for as long as you can. Enjoy the roles you're in. Enjoy the people. Enjoy the learnings. Because that's really important. That's the most important thing.
I love that. And just on the flip of that, so let's say I'm the person who is chomping at the bit to become a leader.
Yeah.
But you're saying, wait, but you want to keep me. You know, people typically want promotions because they want more money.
Yeah.
What are other things besides the learning that you can do to entice people to stay? What other things people should be looking out for?
I don't think you can underestimate the impact of the learning.
Okay.
So I've built out a learning journey. It's a 10-part learning journey, which talks about the different kinds of leadership. And it's an accreditation which people go through. For people who work for me, they all go through the same learning journey, which is hugely valuable. It's a combination of 20 years of my career.
Yeah.
So as much as you can say, yeah, brilliant, can I take that to the bank or can I use that to pay my mortgage? Yeah. No, you can't. It's not exchangeable for cash. But it's super helpful. So I think giving them exposure to how I work more directly, mm-hmm. how I make decisions and my decision-making framework. So I've got what I call a quick decision-making framework and a more considered one. One's called SAFCORN, which I'll be able to share you a link to. It's based on the best practices in terms of military leadership.
Okay.
And then there's my quick decision-making framework, which is it legal? Is it moral? And is it professional?
Mm.
So coaching people in terms of how you make decisions is a really important skill, which not a lot of people get in life.
Yeah. As you've just said that, when you were in the military, were you just a paratrooper? Were you a lieutenant? Were you in charge of people?
I had some leadership responsibility, yeah, but okay. I wasn't an officer, no.
Because my question was going to be like, yeah, how did you take the learnings that you had from that time and, yeah, apply it to what you're doing now?
It's a lifetime ago.
You mentioned like SAFCON and the fact that it was learned from, like, did you take any other kind of military learnings that you...
Not intentionally.
Okay.
I think the best leadership lessons I've learned in my career, this traditional corporate environment, which is, and also great lessons you get from family life, which is doing the right thing. Like you and me, fundamentally, I know we're going to agree on stuff because we think about things the right way. By that I mean, you're not going to steal anybody's work.
Yeah,
you're not going to take credit for stuff you haven't done.
No way.
You want people to be recognised for the good work they've done. So,
100%.
Yeah, I think it's more just about probably being brought up the right way and having some good leadership examples along the way.
With all of the leadership roles you've had, have they all been in the e-commerce and tech industry?
Yes.
What is it about the e-com and tech industry that you're attracted to?
I like that it's a relatable technology. So it touches parts of people's daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
I like the people. I'm hooked on the people.
Mm-hmm.
I like that in most cases, what we do is about storytelling, which is a really undervalued skill. You know, because if you talk about essentially what people's products do, if you focus on, if you just press this button, this thing happens, that's not super interesting.
No.
But if you start talking about the value proposition and how it can transform a buyer journey or how it can introduce loyalty where it wasn't there before, I really like that. So I like the storytelling element of it. People, like I say, and the opportunity to do some travel.
Hmm.
And also, like, I wouldn't underestimate the importance of the fact that you can earn really well, which has been important to me. It's not the most important thing, but it's also been foundational for the fact that, you know, as I said, I want to be a motorbike man, and motorbikes aren't free.
And in terms of the industry as a whole, what would you say is like a common misconception?
I love that question. I think the biggest misconception people have about the corporate world at all is that being ruthless is good.
Mm.
And I think being the antithesis of ruthless is probably the best thing you can be. Being thoughtful, being kind, it's such an underrated skill. Asking someone how they are is easy. Because, in fact, I learned this in lockdown. Because you could ask people how they are. They go, how are you? Fine. You know, they haven't left their house for 3 days.
Yeah.
How are you? Fine. But we get back to face-to-face, and I say, how are you? You go, fine. And I go, no, how are you? And you get such a different answer.
Yeah.
So investing in people and also remembering their answers and revisiting those answers is really important.
Yeah. And can I just like piggyback off that? Like being the antithesis of ruthless, another reason it's beneficial is because when people really care, they get nervous. And nerves aren't necessarily always a bad thing. I think nerves just show that you care.
Yeah.
So sometimes, yeah, like somebody might fluff their lines or they might not say something in the most polished way in that moment. But by not being ruthless and, yeah, having that empathy, you actually calm people down and it allows them to settle into their best work a lot quicker. And I think especially in like interview processes, because there's like some people might be polished, but it's a rehearsed script, and they might actually not be able, when the going gets tough, they might actually not be able to work on the fly. And I've always thought about it, like, what's the key thing I look for if I'm hiring somebody? It's a willingness to learn and just take on feedback well, because I think ultimately, given enough time, you'll see the real benefits of someone's strengths.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Yeah. I can see. Yeah.
Yeah. What would you say is the most stressful part of being a commercial leader?
You got the day-to-day stuff, which is, you know, delivery, because that's page one, line one. You're in a delivery-based role. I'm quite good at compartmentalizing that now and managing it successfully. I think probably the most challenging part is the people. It's the best part and also the most challenging part is the people.
Is that just because people are unpredictable? or why?
Just stuff happens, right?
Yeah.
Stuff happens. Yeah, that's the hardest part and also the best part.
Okay. And when there are difficult situations, to anybody who's listening to this and wanting, you know, some advice on how to navigate such things as the people, like, yeah, what would your advice be?
Stop. Pause. Think. Your instinctive reaction as a leader, focused on that page one, line one objective, which is delivery, is probably not the right answer.
Mm.
So stop and pause. Take the time to understand the context and the broader environment. Just take some time to understand.
Okay. And, you know,
seek the counsel of others, speak to your leaders. Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, that's absolutely fine. I was actually going to say, yeah, talking about like speaking to other leaders, there are going to be people who don't see eye to eye.
Yeah, of course.
Like, how is it that you go about managing those kinds of situations?
That's all right if people don't see eye to eye. That's kind of okay.
Mm-hmm.
The way I would measure the success of a culture would be that people say nice things behind each other's backs and have really frank, honest conversations to their faces. So me as a leader, when I say, how's John or Jane getting on? I kind of want someone to go, brilliant, she's great, he's great, we're all fine. But I know they're saying, hey, like, the way you managed that situation wasn't optimal for me. I don't think it got the client's best interests completely captured in that topic, for example. But you want to hear people having those kind of conversations. I don't want people to lie to me or stage manage situations.
Yeah.
But it's quite a like good combat indicator for me to see that people are loyal to each other and also being thoughtful about how they present each other to me. So I hope that, does that give you sense?
Yeah. So basically keeping each other accountable but presenting a united front. That's the way I took that.
Perfect.
Yeah. And on the flip side, what would you say is the most rewarding aspect of being a commercial leader?
I think it's watching the growth for people. Because it's a difference between being proud and being prideful, I think. Because you can take real pride in seeing people go on to do great things and have a great and enviable life. People getting married, people affording houses or acquiring things which are helpful for them for the next stage of their life. So, yeah, I think watching people go on to be successful is probably one of the great joys of it.
Yeah, love it. To anybody who is listening to this and is looking to take the next step into leadership, what would your main piece of advice be for them?
Be authentic. Find find out what you're good at. Self-awareness, it begins and ends with self-awareness as a leader. So work out what you're good at and what you're not good at. Mm. Make sure that your team that you're going to lead and serve have an authentic view of you. Because if you present yourself as someone kind of superman who's infallible, or super girl who's never makes mistakes, you're gonna come a cropper, and you're gonna need them to support you. So be self-aware enough to know what you're good at and what your work-ons are. Be transparent with your team about what they are. Be consistent in your moods and how you behave. Mm-hmm. Create processes, make them measurable, repeatable, and optimizable. Create documents and guidelines for people to work from. There's some real simple stuff, like commission rules only ever bend one way. Same with holiday rules. Like, a little thing to you, a small amount of money to you, is a huge thing to someone at home. Mm. So just give a little. Just always give. It's fine. There's enough in the pot for a business, generally, that you can always just be a little bit more generous. Enjoy it, right? Everyone's in a rush to be the best manager and have the... But just take some time to learn. Your team will enjoy seeing you learn along the way. Be humble. I'm very aware that what I do is not saving lives. Mm. It's important. It's really important. There's a value creation piece for businesses, for our people, but I'm not saving lives.
Yeah.
So have some fun along the way, right? It's Martech. It's going to be fun. Take some time out to laugh at yourself and encourage your team to do the same. You asked me specifically, what can someone do? Read on your topic. Understand what good leaders look like. Understand what kind of leader you are and what leader you want to be like. Have a plan. Work out where you want to be in like 5 and 10 years and measure yourself against that plan. Not every day, because that's the road to madness, but maybe take a checkpoint every 6 or 12 months to say, how am I getting on?
Do you have any mentors?
Yes.
And do you encourage mentors?
Absolutely. I think it's invaluable.
And to somebody who is like, where do I get a mentor from? Is it somebody in my organization? Is it somebody out of your organization? Yeah, what would your approach be to getting a mentor?
I would have counseled against having someone inside your organization.
Okay.
But yeah, if it's no other option, then that's great. The people I speak to are people I've worked with and know and trust professionally, but they're now one or two removed. Perfectly. One is based in Australia.
Mm.
Great mentor, great confidant. So I think you want to find, how do you get mentors? Ask. There's nothing more flattering than someone saying, hey, I think what you're doing is really cool. I think I can learn from you. I'd probably like to spend an hour a month with you going through some things that I'm working on, get your opinion, or better still, I'll tell you what I intend to do, but I'd love to get your feedback on it. So give people a clear indication about what the expectation is on your side, how much time it's going to take up, and ask. Right? The worst thing they can say is no. They might say, no, I can't do once a month, but I could do once every couple of months. Yeah. So just ask.
I love it. I feel like to the aspiring leader, we've given them lots of nuggets, but we're not done. You also mentioned the fact that you do consulting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about the consultancy you do and who it's targeted at?
Yeah, so I do go-to-market leadership consulting for a mixture of brands and agencies. In some instances where they're looking to... So it's day-to-day coaching, how you do the good blocking and tackling of being a commercial leader. Some of it is around building sales playbooks, so how we actually go about winning business. Some of it's doing stuff around defining things like key account lists, whale account lists. So for me, a whale account is a business which is going to change your fortunes by revenue or by reputation, giving people a playbook for how they tackle those things, how they think about pipeline generation, how they think about common challenges. Okay. So, and I love it. It's really fun. It gives me the best of both worlds. It gives me the immediacy of being close to the deals, which I still love and never want to grow out of, but also being a kind of have a more strategic view as well.
Understood. And when you're doing that consulting for brands, businesses, having multiple clients, does it mean that you have to understand the story that they're trying to tell and sell for each individual client and brand?
Absolutely. It's not a cookie cutter approach. It has to be bespoke because it's a consultation. So the more time I, like any good sales process, the more time I spend in discovery, the better. And I've got to the end of some discoveries and actually said, I'm probably not the right person for you, which is invaluable for them because I could shoehorn in my experience to an extent, but that's not the way I want to work.
Yeah.
So taking the time in discovery to work out how you're going to do it, presenting what that looks like, means you could be a really good trusted advisor. And also, don't overstay your welcome, right? because I can say I see this as a 6 month project. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be paying me for another 12 months. 6 months is normally a fairly standard engagement for me at the moment.
You used the phrase there, trusted advisor. I love it. What is your approach to becoming a trusted advisor?
You by default have to tell the truth at all stages. Mm-hmm. That honest feedback loop, what I did well, what I did badly, what I did differently, creating that kind of almost transactional level of honesty is really important part of you becoming a trusted advisor. Telling people stuff that they probably don't want to hear. Mm-hmm. Like I give reference to the example where someone said, I want to go and be this SDR for the fourth time, and saying, I don't think you should, because that's hard. That's probably hard for that person to hear.
Yeah.
But it was ultimately it's honest advice. Yeah. I slept well last night knowing that I said something which was really hard to hear, but it was the truth. And that's that I can kind of live with. So defaulting to honesty, always giving a reference of an example or a case study as to why you're making that observation or why you're making that decision. Backing up with data is also super helpful, right? Because anybody can say, well, what you want to do is this. It sounds fairly compelling, but you can present some optionality and suggest what the potential outcomes would be with some data points. That makes you someone people trust.
And just on that, I'm not trying to catch you out, like with presenting that data, like to me, I'm thinking about, oh, if I'm doing this, like where is it you get the data from? Is it Google? Is it from results you've had with other clients? Yeah, where is it you're finding that truth to kind of sell them those options that they have?
Some of it is data which currently exists in their business.
Okay.
Some of it's based on my own experience. Some is it from speaking to people in the industry and mm-hmm. asking their points of view. Mm-hmm. So there's no single source of truth.
Okay, but dependent on the situation, you've got the different places where you can pull and you can leverage from.
Yeah, bear in mind, I've also got the advantage that I'm coming into these situations unemotionally. The goal, page one, line one, is revenue or growth. Mm-hmm. Once I understand that, I understand the lay of the land, the pieces I've got on the board in terms of people, resources, budget, etc. I'm not tied to do anything other than deliver for that business, which puts me in an enviable place where I can just tell them the unvarnished truth. Rather than situations I've seen in the past, or where someone says, well, we don't want to change that because it will unsettle Johnny, because that's not the way Johnny likes to work. Actually, you need to be comfortable enough that you have to make tough decisions sometimes.
And going into businesses for 6 months at a time versus being like a permanent employee somewhere, how does it differ? Is it a different relationship you have with the people because you're not building up those long-term relationships?
I think so. Also, they have a different relationship with you.
Yeah.
Because you're not here to stay. I'm not anti-finding my forever home, but it just needs to be the right opportunity for me.
Yeah.
I think, the way people perceive you is different. And as a result, the way you behave is different. And also, you've got a very clear mandate, which is X and Y. Mm. Whereas other people, their goal is often delivery against their KPIs, but also career growth and career development. And also, longer term relationships building. Whether for me, it's like, get this business to success.
So if I was to ask you the question, what do you prefer? Short-term consultancy or long-term home? What would you say?
I'm going to give you such a consultant answer now.
Okay.
I think it depends on the opportunity. For me, it's about the vision, the founder vision. Mm-hmm. If I can get behind the vision, I'm pretty sure I could sell anything.
Yeah.
If I can believe, then I'm all in. So the consultancy is great because it gives me lots of snapshots to great founders and what they're doing, mm-hmm. which I love. But also long-term, finding a founder, you think, I believe in you and I believe in what you're saying so much that I want to do this for as long as I'm adding value.
Okay, I love it. And then final thing, this is just before I go into the next section, in terms of, like finding business or businesses finding you, how do you go about doing it, or how can businesses go about reaching out to you for your expertise?
I haven't done any business development at all. Mm-hmm. It's been word of mouth and referees so far. So for as long as that lasts, great. I know what you're going to say. You sound like the worst business developer in the world.
No. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's what they say.
But no, you need a pipeline. So. Yeah. Probably what I'll be thinking of towards the second half of the year is how I can build that pipeline. But at the moment, I've got plenty of work, plenty of things to do, plenty of projects, which I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. I love that. You sound like you do a lot. And I always say this to my guests. Do you have any productivity hacks?
Run.
Okay.
Run. Not between meetings. But for me, the discipline of running is really important because it's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Getting out running, and because that conditions you, I think, as a person. Mm-hmm. Also, to use a bit of a techie analogy, when I run, it accesses my RAM, my random access memory. Mm-hmm. So I process things when I'm running, which I probably don't have time to do in my normal day-to-day. So decision-making or thinking about things happens almost subconsciously when I go about running. So it sounds super basic, but actually just the discipline of running is really helpful for me in lots of regards. Mm-hmm. There's other cool stuff you can use, like Superhuman and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, the biggest life hack, turn off your phone and stop scrolling.
Okay.
I've limited myself to 15 minutes social media a day.
Really?
Yeah. And it's like it's given me hours back of my life.
Yeah.
I have a little fix. I want to see your cat pictures. I want to see what you have for dinner. I want to see your holidays. Of course I do. But I don't need to spend more than 15 minutes on it a day. There's loads of stuff I could be doing. I should be doing.
Yeah.
Whether it's, if you want to get that dopamine fix, use that time to message your friends, to catch up on them, to talk to them. But banally looking at what, you know, some influencer you don't really know very well is not a great use of my time. So that's been a big productivity hack for me.
Okay. I don't know if I can reduce myself to a 15-minute scroll on Twitter. You can, maybe 15 minutes an hour. No, I'm joking.
Try 30, try 45. Try.
Okay. Just like I realised I didn't ask this, and I want to be unequivocally clear on this. And we're gonna go step by step. So, if we go to a salesperson, what are the key skills that make a great salesperson?
Intellectual curiosity.
Okay.
So people who want to understand why things work a certain way, and people who are intellectually curious enough that they're prepared to challenge it. So people who ask questions, essentially. Yeah. That's something I look for.
I love it. And then what are the key skills that make a great sales manager?
Self-awareness. Discipline. Scar tissue. So I think there's no substitute for making a few mistakes along the way, then being painful enough that you want to help other people avoid them, and you're vulnerable enough that you're happy to share what those mistakes were so people can learn from them along the way. But there's no shortcuts to being a good sales leader. You just have to have screwed up enough times.
And then so manager and then leader. Would you say the skills, well, they do vary differently. So yeah, for a sales leader, what would you say?
I'd also say for any kind of leadership role in a commercial world, you also need to have been a good salesperson. Mm-hmm. Because the world's full of spreadsheet managers, and the world needs less spreadsheet managers. People want to know you've done the job, you felt the heat, you've won deals on the last day or month of the quarter or the year, and they want to know how you've done it. Mm-hmm. And you can't, there's no hack for that. You just need to have done it.
Sorry to jump in there. Do you feel like you need to have done sales to be anywhere in leadership? So I'm talking like chief revenue officer, chief customer officer, all along that rung. Do you think you have to have been there and done it?
I think, yeah, I'd say so. For those particular roles, absolutely. Okay. There's no substitute, or been in a quota carrying commercial role.
Okay.
I don't think there's any substitute for it.
Okay. I love that. We mentioned earlier, people need to, you know, study and learn. Are there any books that you recommend to people on that you can recommend to people on leadership?
There's a book called Leadership, written, it's the Harvard Business Review. It's a selection of essays. Mm-hmm. That's formed part of the 10 leadership journeys, which I spoke about. Highly recommend that. They're like 800,000 word essays, really digestible, really understandable, really relatable, backed up by lots of data and science. Definitely worth a read. You can get it on Amazon for like 10 quid.
Okay.
I think if you read that, and you could read that book every day for the rest of your life and still learn something on the last day. Mm-hmm. So it's a really invaluable book. There's also loads of great books and textbooks out there. A book I've read, which I've enjoyed enormously, is The Comfort Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Highly recommend it. It's the importance of braving discomfort. And I think the importance of braving discomfort as a leader is not to be underestimated.
Yeah.
Because the fact that I'm prepared to make myself uncomfortable to make my team comfortable is a really useful leadership lesson.
I love that. And yeah, on that, like talking about stress, like what's your view on like burnout? Is it something that you see regularly in leaders? And if so, how is it we can mitigate against it?
If you burn someone out, you've done something terrible. Like, let's not underestimate it. People get tired. I'm tired today. I've got two kids. And that's all right. It's fine to be tired. Mm-hmm. Burning someone out is really, that's a serious crime. Okay. Because someone's really burnt out. Like, they're no good. They're no good at home. They're no good to you. They're no good for months. So you need to be really precious about avoiding how you burn people out. Part of that is about, you know, being disciplined about how you contact them, the hours you contact them, the channels you contact them, letting them know the urgency with which you need them to reply. And letting them know, you know, you don't need them on the weekends. Mm-hmm. But if I send, you know, I used to have a disclaimer, which is at the bottom of my emails, which says, if I send this out of work time, please ignore, your rest time is precious. Yeah. Sending people those clear signals that there's no expectation that they're on charge 24 hours a day. Your burnout is an all too familiar thing, which I've seen with senior leaders or with leaderships. So yeah, it's a really important thing to avoid.
And then, yeah, just in terms of... men's health in general. Any advice you can give? Because I feel like, yeah, people always want to, yeah, take on a lot and maybe not check up on themselves. Any advice you want to give around health?
Yeah, I can certainly share a personal story. Part of what's got me to this place now today is my own cancer story. So it was May 17th last year I had the operation diagnosed, I think, on May the 2nd. I went through kind of a period of a big operation and then months and months of chemo. Luckily, I was a baldy before, so I didn't have an impact. I don't mean to make light of it. It's just how I cope. Could I have got it to it a bit sooner? Yeah, probably. There were clear signs. Like my concentration was certainly lagging. And what I did, for example, when I read an email, a five-line email, I'd have to read it and read it and read it to understand it.
Just because things weren't going in?
Yeah. I was really anemic. So it's affecting my concentration. I also saw things like my running. I love to run, despite the fact I'm not the world's best. So I went from running 8 to 9 to 10 to 11 to 12-minute miles. Now, running a 12-minute mile is hard because it's slightly slower than walking. So What I did is, I'm not running very well, so I'll run more.
Wow.
I can't concentrate, so what I'll do is I didn't tell anybody.
Wow.
I just worked harder and worked longer and obviously wore myself out. So in the end, my wife noticed that, you know, I wasn't quite myself, and we went through a process. So particularly for men, the temptation is to do what I did. Just don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
Keep your mouth shut. Get it done. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Walk it off, mate. So particularly my experience for men, women are a bit smarter. They just go, I don't feel well. I'll go and see a doctor. I'd always advise for men and women to do the same. But that's been my journey. Luckily, I'm out the other side. I'm well, healthy, happy. Still feels good to say that. Cancer-free, or NED as they say, no existence of disease. Hence, I'm focusing on the things I like to do.
Love that.
And working. And also, when my career nearly got taken away, because I literally love what I do, I'd probably do it for free. If I work for you as a consultant, I don't mean that.
Yes.
I would literally do it for free. I literally love it.
Yeah.
When that nearly got taken away, that's confirmed to me why the importance of what I do to me and why I love to do it.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, just to add there, because, you know, hearing your story is something that I think a lot of people think about. But, like, should we be going for screens, even young people? Because it happens to young people just as well as it happens to older people. Should we just be, is there anywhere particular that we can go to actually just have a full body health check?
Do you know what? I wish I had the answer to that. I don't know. I'm
going to check and I'm going to put it in the notes then.
I certainly had leading indicators of symptoms.
Okay.
Which, if I'd have just looked online or just spoken to my doctor more presumptively, it wouldn't have been avoided, but it would have probably not been such a scramble to get the treatment I needed.
Yeah. But, you know, knowing you, you were so positive. In such a, I don't want to call it a dark time, but it's a difficult time. Just really happy to see you here. This has been such a wonderful conversation. Just before we get into the quick fire round, where does Jamie see himself in the next 5 and 10 years?
I think I need to be honest with myself about how many more cycles I've got left in terms of how long I'm going to be relevant, because I'm 46 now. I'm young at heart. And I've keep myself young at heart. But fast forward 10 years, I don't know, or 10, 15 years, do I want to be doing this startup journey? Probably not. So I'm probably going to be, well, I'll be aiming for a CEO type role by year 10. But along the way, I'll probably do a couple more cycles of this and maybe focus on some consultancy work along the way.
And then as you prepare for the CEO type role, what is it you're going to be doing from now to the next 10 years to make sure you're ready to take that role on?
So that conversation starts with, what do you think qualifies you for this role, Jamie? And I can say, well, I can tell you now, I've been preparing for this for the last 10 years. It's speaking to the good and the great. It's asking their questions. It's looking for not quite the life hacks, but the stories of their success, the lessons they've learned along the way, reading extensively, becoming a master of my trade.
I love it. And then just before we go, to the listener, are there any, is there any just bits of advice or a takeaway you want the listener to have today? And it could be about anything.
That's a big one. Enjoy it. Enjoy your career. It's precious. There's not a race to be a director or a manager. You don't need to. Find your tribe, find your people, enjoy the moments for what they are. Make sure you have healthy boundaries. There's no email which you can send on a Saturday night when you're sitting with your friends or your family or your loved ones that can't wait until Monday morning. There's no email. So to prioritise those things, put some healthy boundaries in place. Run, prioritise your health, and be really mindful of the fact that actually the more proactive you can be around your health, your mental health as well as your physical health, the longer you'll have in the game and the more chance you'll have to be successful.
Jamie, this has been such a great conversation. We do have a quick fire round. Are you ready?
Ready.
Okay, here we go. Money or happiness?
That is a hard question because the obvious answer is happiness. But actually, I think it's more nuanced because actually short-term happiness is really bad for you. So seeking out the quick thrills, the quick fixes, and working hard at money will give you a sustainable future. So I think there's a nuanced answer between the two, which is balance.
Okay.
Just balance. But have a pension, pay into your pension, save your money. I know loads of people who've done really well in the commercial world, but have a pension which is worth about £4.50. Overpay into your pension.
And look at that when you're looking at your comp packages, what the pension contribution is. Because it really does.
Because eventually you could live as long as me. Imagine that. And when you do, you want to make sure your pension is going to be something which is going to sustain you as you get older and want to do things like play golf or whatever. I'll end up
ride motorcycles.
Ride motorbikes. Exactly, yeah.
All right, work from home or work from the office?
My wife always says I'm more dog than cat. So I get my energy from being around people. I love being around people, but I also know it's important for me to have a little bit of a break, and also important for the teams that I lead and serve to have a little bit of a break from me. So I think hybrid is my preference, but with an inclination towards just being around people, and particularly being around customers as much as I possibly can.
I love it. Do you have a favourite saying or saying you live by?
Yeah. Do or do not, there is no try.
Ah, yes, of course. Love it. Would you rather travel to the past or to the future?
Can I come home?
Yeah.
So I'll just go there and come back?
Whatever you want. Whatever you want.
I mean, this is a very ridiculous thing. I don't know why I'm qualified. Intellectual curiosity, right? The future. I'm fascinated.
To see what's going to happen.
Yeah, I want to go on the first motorbike hover man. Yeah. I want to see if kids are still doing that in 100, 200 years.
We're going to be so shocked by what they're doing, but we're already doing some crazy stuff now. I was asked, who has it easier, men or women?
I love that question. I can only speak from my experience as a human. I think there's enormous pressures on both genders. Mm-hmm. I think for women, the body dysmorphia debate, which is going on in the media, is just so overdue. I think there's so much incredible undue pressure on women, particularly young women. I'm the father of a little girl as well as a little boy, so that really worries me going forward, because it's the natural sense about what being healthy is really distorted. I think for men there's a challenge around mental, physical health, not to a greater or lesser extent than women. But from my own experience, I think, you know, guys toughing out and getting on with stuff is a real ongoing challenge for us. And also the expectation that you are kind, you're strong, you can do DIY, you've got loads of money, you've got a car, but you're environmentally friendly. You're safe for the future, but you're still fun. Mm. That expectation, particularly on younger men, is really tough. So I don't think anybody's got it harder particularly. I think
it's hard for everyone.
It's hard for everybody, but I think probably historically it's been significantly harder for women without a question. Mm. Well, I think the answer is really simple. It's kindness. Mm. Just be kind to yourself.
100%.
Just be kind to each other.
I love it. Dream dinner guests.
Oi, oi. Can I have you?
Of course you can.
Okay. That's such a good question. Of all time? Anyone?
Yeah, dead or alive.
Alive when they're there, not just dead person. Fine. I'm going to go Elvis Presley. I'm a huge Elvis fan. I named both my kids after Elvis Presley. I don't know if you knew that.
No.
Isabel Grace, short for Gracelands, and the other one's Jacob Elvis. That's his actual middle name.
Wow.
Huge fan. So, Elvis, you're there, obviously.
One more for good measure.
Muhammad Ali.
Okay. That's a great trio. Yeah, you put me up there with the greats. Jamie, this has been such a great conversation. We do have a closing tradition on this podcast.
Okay.
So with everything that we've discussed and with everything you've been through, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your younger self, and would you still be doing the same thing?
I'll answer that in reverse order. Yeah, I've had a great career and a great life. I've made loads of mistakes, but I've also got lots of things right. I've got it mostly right, I think, and I feel proud in that regard. So yeah, I would do it all again. I'd say probably slow down, mate. Slow down. Stop and smell the roses. There's loads of... What advice would I give myself? I'd say you're going to get there. You're not going to get there as quick as you want, and the destination won't be exactly the one you want. But by doing the right thing and being a good person, you're kind of paying into a bank account. You're paying into like a pension.
Mm.
And it will pay you back later. So slow down, enjoy it. You're getting it right and it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right.
I love it. What would
your advice be to your younger self?
Oof. No one's ever asked me that on this podcast. My advice to my younger self would be do what makes you happy. Because I think in the society that we live in, as long as you're like the best or the top 5% of what you do, you can get paid for it. So mine would be follow what truly makes you happy from as young as possible. And one of the reasons for the podcast is like, don't just do what your parents say. Like, you don't have to go to university and become a doctor or become an accountant. It's like, follow your passions. Sometimes, like when I left university, I did economics and management, which sounds great, but I hated the course. And I think going back, I probably would have done history because I'm fascinated by history and dates just stick in my mind. So it would have been easy to do the essays. Amazing. For me.
It's why I'm so proud to know you. That's a great answer. Thank you for sharing it.
No. Thank you for asking it. Now I know what it's like being on the other side. Goodness gracious. Jamie, where can people find you? Do you want to plug any socials, any LinkedIn?
Find me on LinkedIn. Okay. I'm super happy to answer questions, help in any way. So yeah, find me on LinkedIn, Jamie Closey.
That's it, guys. If you've gotten to this point of the podcast, you know what to do. Like, subscribe, share. Please continue to comment. Let us know who you want to hear from next. This has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Now go and get going.